I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, we did a show about the documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc., which focuses on who really benefits from the pink ribbon campaigns. The film also raises a very important question. Why is the focus on finding a cure rather than the cause? And why don't we ever hear the word prevention in these campaigns? We had a huge response to that show. Many of you called or wrote in to request a show on how we can reduce our risk of breast cancer and to really focus on prevention. So today we're doing just that. And you may have heard the sobering statistics. 30 years ago, 1 in 14 women were diagnosed with breast cancer. Today, it's 1 in 8. So why has that number changed so dramatically? What do we know now that we didn't know 30 years ago? And what areas still need research? What role do toxics play? What about food and the environment? And who's asking these questions? Today, we are joined by Shirima Rasanagama. She is Director of Science at the Breast Cancer Fund, an organization that works to prevent breast cancer by eliminating our exposure to toxic chemicals and radiation linked to the disease. Before coming to the Breast Cancer Fund, Shirima was the founding academic coordinator at the UC Berkeley Institute for the Environment, where she built the institute from the ground up and fostered discussion on environmental issues. Hi, Shirima. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. It's great to have you. And we're also joined by Joyce Bickler, Deputy Director of Breast Cancer Action, a national grassroots education and advocacy organization that is well known for its Think Before You Pink campaign. In 1972, Joyce was diagnosed with vaginal and cervical cancer. 2 years later, she underwent a radical hysterectomy. Medical testimony linked the cancer to the DES pills that had been prescribed for her mother in 1953. DES is a generic drug once widely used to prevent pregnancy complications. She's the author of Joyce Bickler, DES Daughter, which details her journey and how she stood up to the pharmaceutical industry. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on today.
It's great to have you. And can you please say the word, what does DES stand for? Because I cannot pronounce this.
It's okay. Many people can't. DES is diethylstilbestrol. It was the first synthetic estrogen that was prescribed to pregnant women, supposedly to prevent miscarriage. As it turns out, the drug never did that. All it did was cause harm to the children born to those women.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating story, and we'll talk about this in the show. So for now, we'll call it DES. Thank you for the pronunciation. We're also joined by Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer. She's been practicing as a holistic medical doctor in private practice for 33 years. She's also one of the founders of the Charlotte Maxwell Complementary Clinic, the first state-licensed holistic clinic for low-income women with cancer. And the clinic has been seeing clients for over 20 years. Hi, Gabriella. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Nice to be on the show. Thanks for doing this show.
Well, I'm really glad to have all of you. Last week, as I said, we did a show about the new documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc., and we were just inundated with phone calls and emails from listeners who said, thanks for doing this, but can you please now talk about causes and prevention? And so when I was doing research for this show, I remember that 2 years ago, we did a show about President Obama's cancer panel, which came out with the first ever government report that found that environmentally caused cancers, quote, needlessly devastate American lives. And I wanted to start out with that because I completely forgot about this report because, as far as I know, not much has come of it. Shirima, can you give us any updates?
Yeah, well, I mean, that report was seminal because it was the first time that we'd had a government report that really shone light on this issue. We at the Breast Cancer Fund, we've been producing a report every 2 years called State of the Evidence, where we outline the developing evidence, the continuing growth of the evidence showing a link between breast cancer, environmental chemicals, and radiation. So since the President's Cancer Panel, we produced our State of the Evidence report in 2010. Following that, late last year, the Institute of Medicine produced a report on breast cancer and the environment, which I will say I agreed with a lot of the science in that we at the Breast Cancer Fund do not believe that that report went far enough in recommending a precautionary approach to these chemicals. And then upcoming, the National Institutes of Health has an interagency breast cancer and the environment research coordinating committee I believe that's the full title, who are producing a report on breast cancer and the environment, and that they expect to come out later this year.
Well, it was incredible to read this. It was a 240-page report.
Yeah.
It also says that environmentally caused cancers, quote, needlessly devastate American lives. Joyce, what were your thoughts when this report came out, and has anything happened as a result?
Well, like Sharima, we've been following the reports that have come out and have certainly been involved in pushing this long before these reports came out to the public. But our concern, like I'm sure everybody on this call, is that 50 to 70% of people with breast cancer have no known risk factors. So the fact that we're first having reports that are, quote-unquote, starting to identify some of the risks is truly horrifying, because we really know for quite a long time there are things like ionizing radiation, exposure to estrogens, toxic chemicals, really do have a relationship and a link to our risk of breast cancer. What we need to do is start to put time and money into protecting the people so that we're not continually exposing ourselves to these chemicals.
And can you elaborate on that? What do you mean when you say 50 to 75% have no known risk factors?
Well, again, there's a lot. You know, breast cancer is a complex disease. It probably, we know it consists probably of many diseases, but we do know some of the risk factors that increase one's likelihood to get it. That's family history, which really only affects a small percentage of people who have breast cancer, that they have a family history of breast cancer, but it's family history, early menstruation, late menopause, late childbirth, or no childbirth at all. Alcohol consumption is a known risk factor, as well as exposure to ionizing radiation. But all of those things combined, only we could attribute 30 to at most 50% of all cases of breast cancer. The other 50 to 70% don't have any of those known risk factors.
And is there much research focusing on the unknown at this point?
Well, our opinion is, there are things we do know, like there's exposure to benzene, vehicle exhaust, other, estrogen-like chemicals in our environment. But there is not enough research. I think only 5% of NCI budget for cancer focuses on prevention and the reasons for this. So we really advocate for a lot more research, independent research on these issues.
And can I add something, Rose?
Sure.
I think the other hard part, and I think this is typical of, what we're dealing with modern science, is there's beginning to be some research on a certain chemical. But what we found is that in cord bloods and in breast milk, there are hundreds of chemicals. So if you do some research on a certain effect of a certain chemical, what we're not learning is what's the effect when we're exposed to 200 of these chemicals. So I think we not only need to do, we need a different model of how to look at the effect of chemicals, because none of us are exposed to one chemical. So when they come up with safe ranges for this chemical, that's really irrelevant, because we're exposed to so many more of these chemicals at the same time.
That is so true, and I think that's really at the heart of the issue of it's so complex, because it's not only the whole concoction of chemicals we're all exposed to, and there's also vulnerable windows of time. Being exposed when you're in utero, if you're an immigrant farm worker who's out in the fields and getting high levels of exposure to chemicals, all of these things really play into it, and we have to look at this not chemical by chemical, because we're never going to solve it that way, but really looking at some reforms that protect on a much larger scale.
But I think we know, in Israel they did a study when they eliminated just DDT. They saw a dramatic decrease in breast cancer in 5 years. We have no doubt that a lot of these chemicals that we know we use are toxic. Now the problem is, how do we deal with it? And so even what we deal with, some of it is they're illegal in the United States, but they're not illegal in other countries. So, we ship them over to other countries where then they're used. And so I think it's really a global problem, and it needs a whole different model of research.
Or when you're talking about body products, they might be illegal in Europe but legal in the United States. So it goes both ways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it goes both ways. Yeah, we certainly found that with cosmetics.
Right.
And Shirima, you wanted to jump in there.
I was going to talk about not only how important it is for research to look at mixtures of chemicals, but also, as Joyce brought up, windows of susceptibility is what they call it, is when people are most susceptible to exposure to these chemicals. So in utero is in the womb, but also when girls are going through puberty and their breast tissue is proliferating, that's another time when exposure to chemicals and radiation can really set them up for later issues with breast cancer. And then during pregnancy, when again your breast tissue is proliferating. So a lot of the tests that they do on toxicity of these chemicals, and most of these chemicals they're not testing for toxicity, but when they do test for them, they're looking at adult animals and the effect on adult animals rather than looking at these windows of susceptibility within the life cycle.
Who's making the decisions to only focus, 5%, spend 5% of resources on prevention? And what will it take to really have a larger conversation about this issue? Because that's what really struck me watching Pink Ribbons, Inc., is that you've got millions of women and men around the world really now marching and hiking and jumping and doing all these things for a cure, but there's so little focus on causes and prevention. Shirima, why is that, and what will it take to change that?
Well, there's a variety of reasons for that. A lot of when you're looking at what the companies are, the research that pharmaceutical companies are doing, obviously they're interested in selling drugs and curing something rather than stopping it before it starts. And with the NIH, that certainly has been the focus in the past. Certainly with this Interagency Breast Cancer Coordinating Committee and following the President's Cancer Panel recommendations, they have started to look at how to increase that slice of the pie. And that's certainly something we advocate for very strongly at the Breast Cancer Fund, to increase the amount of money going to primary prevention, because we want to stop this disease before it starts. And it's a lot of lobbying of appropriations committees. It's a lot of talking to your Congress people about why aren't we spending more money on prevention. And it's something that we work very hard on at the Breast Cancer Fund.
And Joyce, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I in some ways, I think I'm just basically an optimist on this, because I think the first step is awareness. And I think with Pink Ribbons, Inc., it's, people now are questioning. You know, when you look at where breast cancer was in the 70s, even the, the 80s and 90s, women were angry and people went to the streets and demanded there was more funding for breast cancer. What happened is the whole movement's gotten hijacked by the whole pink ribbon haze of using breast cancer to market, increase corporate profits and market products. And now I think we're hopefully getting back between the work of Breast Cancer Fund, Breast Cancer Action, our Think Before You Pink campaign, Pink Ribbons, Inc., to have people stop and say, wait a minute, this isn't about a warm, fuzzy, nice, rah-rah disease. We've got to make some changes, and prevention's a key part of it. How we do that is, I think, together as individuals coming together and demanding that there's more funding for prevention, figuring out some of the answers, not just doing the same thing over and over again, is the only way we're going to make some change. But I think together people can do that. So I'm hopeful the next couple of years we'll at least see a shift in where the money's going.
And Gabriella?
Well, I think it points to the more systemic problems of our society. I think when I went to medical school in the 70s, research was primarily done by the government. Now, most medical research is done by drug companies. And so, like Shirina said, what our emphasis is on is cure. But I think it really is about changing the way medicine is part of our system. It's going to take a change in that to really see a change in how we do research.
And that is Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer. She's been practicing as a holistic medical doctor in private practice for 33 years. She's also one of the founders of the Charlotte Maxwell Complementary Clinic, the first state-licensed holistic clinic for low-income women with cancer. We're also joined by Joyce Bickler, Deputy Director for Breast Cancer Action, a national grassroots education organization that's well-known for its Think Before You Pink campaign, and she's the author of Joyce Bickler, DES Daughter, which details her cancer journey and how she stood up to the pharmaceutical industry. We're also joined by Shirima Rasanayagam, Director of Science at the Breast Cancer Fund, an organization that works to prevent breast cancer by eliminating our exposure to toxic chemicals and radiation. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about breast cancer, specifically causes and prevention? If you've ever dealt with breast cancer, we'd love to hear from you. Did you feel like, or do you feel like you're getting the information that you needed? If you work in health and have thoughts about cancer prevention, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you don't feel like you're imminently at risk, do you still take measures to avoid elements in the environment that are known carcinogens? And where do you go to find this information? And I'd love to hear from you also when we talk about how the movement back in the 80s involved women taking to the streets, standing in front of the corporations to say, you're not going to get away with polluting our environment and our bodies. And now there's so much of a focus on wearing pink and buying pink products. So what will it take to go back to the streets to actually talk about these very important issues? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org and email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Virginia in Berkeley. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I, like many people, had somebody close to me who was suffering from breast cancer. So I went to the Women's Cancer Resource Center in Berkeley, which was a great resource. And there I did meet people from the Breast Cancer Fund. It was an awesome organization, and it sounds like it still is. And one thing that I learned in doing a lot of research, and I've worked with these machines, actually, as a dispatcher, for people that calibrate them, the mammography machines in hospitals are often owned by big companies like General Electric, who have a big stake in selling more of them. And lots of research has been done, or not enough, but more and more since I first started this, that seemed it even caused people to change the recommendations for women getting mammograms. Mammogram is ionizing radiation, and I think that's important, so I just wanted to put that out there.
All right, thank you. Would you like to tackle that one, Joyce, and talk about these machines and their corporate ties?
Yes.
And is this an issue?
Yeah, it is an issue on a lot of levels that we could touch on today. And as the caller said, in the early days, the mammography machines were actually putting out pretty high levels of ionizing radiation as part of the mammography process. That amount of radiation has gotten better over the years, but what did we do in this country when we decided we couldn't use those machines in the U.S.? We actually exported those machines into developing countries. So instead of just getting rid of them and saying these aren't safe for anybody, we've exported the problem around the world. So as I believe Gabrielle said, this is a global problem and something we shouldn't just think of what's good for us in this country. We have to look a little broader to make sure nobody's exposed to that. So, that's one issue about it. And the other thing that I think is really important, we've been sold a premise by a lot of organizations that having a mammography is your best, is the slogan, your best prevention against breast cancer. Well, mammography has never been, nor is it preventing anything. All it is a test that actually will detect if you have breast cancer. It does not prevent breast cancer. But it gives this kind of comfort that as long as you do mammography, everything's going to be okay. And that's not the case at all. So I think once people, again, aren't so comforted with the tools we have to screen and treat breast cancer, they should be much more aware of how do we prevent the disease in the first place.
Dr. Heinzheimer, what would you add to that? Because I often hear women talk about when they're going to get their first mammogram and you better make your appointment.
Well, I think, the thing about breast cancer is we know very little. And like we talked, it's a complex set of diseases probably, and it's a lot of factors that happen at once, including probably bad luck. And I think in this country, prevention is often confused with early detection. It has nothing to do with prevention, mammography. And yet, I still believe that early detection is one of the best ways to have a higher cure rate with breast cancer. So I think even though we're very confused about when we should do mammograms, how often we should do them, they're a bad test, but we don't have an alternative. Although I think thermography might be something we need to do some more research about. Thermography is a test using infrared and looking for inflammation or more activity in the breast that might be something we want to do more research about because it is no radiation. But I think the thing is that, in my opinion, mammography is still a useful tool for early detection. It has nothing to do with prevention.
May I add something?
Sure, Sharima.
Absolutely, mammography is key for early detection. But as with all ionizing radiation, there is a risk factor, and it's important that you speak with your provider to decide when would be best for you to have a mammogram and how often. We're very concerned about CT scans, which give you a much higher dose of radiation for every scan you have, and there's been a huge increase in the number of CT scans performed on children and on adults in the US. There has recently, the FDA have come out and said that there needs to be better regulation of CT scans of children because sometimes the machines aren't calibrated for a smaller body, and so they're getting a much higher dose of radiation than they should. And so I know the FDA is tackling that, but again, whenever there's ionizing radiation involved, you should discuss with your provider what's the appropriate level and whether it's the best way for you to have your diagnosis.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Virginia. Let's take one more call before we go to break. Let's hear from Kim in Los Altos. Hi, Kim.
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air, and we have about a minute until we go to break.
Okay. I'm on nearing the end of a breast cancer treatment, and it was a progesterone receptor positive, and there's a lot of conflicting information about the consumption of soy, and I wondered, does it mimic a weak estrogen in our bloodstream? Should we avoid it or limit it? What's the research?
Yes. I'd like to jump in.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of good evidence,
Gabriella,
that shows that soy is what's called a phytoestrogen, meaning it is a plant-based estrogen, but that it actually blocks xenoestrogens, these chemicals or other things that turn on estrogen receptors in the breast. So I think there's a lot of evidence, in my opinion, and I think, again, stay tuned, this may change, that soy is absolutely fine for women with breast cancer. It may even be protective. I think, like everything, moderation, because actually what we do know is that too much soy can inhibit the thyroid gland. So I think it's absolutely fine and probably good for women to have organic. And here's an issue with soy, because soy is such a genetically modified food because it's mainly used as a pig food. You know,
right. And Gabriella, hold that thought, because we have to take a quick break. And
okay. We'll
get a response from Gabriella. We'll have her continue her thought, and then we'll get responses from Sharima and Joyce. We're talking today about breast cancer, specifically causes and prevention. And we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation about Silicon Valley's political agenda. Last week, we did a show about Amazon, and again, we got such an overwhelming response. We thought, well, what about the other tech companies? Where are they giving their money, and what is their political agenda? So we'll be talking about Silicon Valley and its connections with Washington, D.C., and also politics at the local level. And then on Wednesday, we'll have a rebroadcast with a conversation we had with Jason Benlevy. We talked about whether we are consuming digital technology or is it consuming us. That's on Wednesday. Today, we are talking about breast cancer causes and prevention. We did a show last week about the new documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc. It focuses on where the billions of dollars go, the money that's raised during the pink ribbon walks, and you see all of the pink ribbon products, everything from guns to vacuum cleaners. Where does that money go? And then also, why is the focus on finding a cure rather than the cause? And why don't we hear the word prevention? And that's what we're talking about on today's show. And we're joined today by Joyce Bickler, Deputy Director of Breast Cancer Action. They're well known for their Think Before You Pink campaign. Joyce is author of Joyce Bickler, DES Daughter, which details her cancer journey. She was diagnosed in 1972 with vaginal and cervical cancer. 2 years later, she underwent a radical hysterectomy. Medical testimony linked the cancer to the DES pills that had been prescribed for her mother. That's a generic drug once widely used to prevent pregnancy complications. Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer has been practicing as a holistic medical doctor in private practice for 33 years. She's one of the founders of the Charlotte Maxwell Complementary Clinic, the first state-licensed holistic clinic for low-income women with cancer. And we're joined by Shirima Rasanayagam. She's director of science at the Breast Cancer Fund, an organization that works to prevent breast cancer by eliminating our exposure to toxic chemicals and radiation. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about this, if you've dealt with breast cancer, if you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. You can also post a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So Kim called in earlier about soy, and Gabriella, you wanted to talk about organic and GMO soy.
Well, I just think that, I mean, I feel pretty much finished. I just think that it's, again, something we need a lot more research about what happens when you genetically modify proteins in food. We see that in wheat. We see that, you know, in many, you know, corn. We're seeing that in many of the major food items that are in so many food. And I think, again, we have no research on what are the health implications for that. It's totally an economic decision.
And Joyce and Shirima, do you agree with that? Do you have anything to add?
So I was just going to say that, yeah, the evidence on soy-based diets is confusing, to say the least. Sometimes they found protective effects. Sometimes there's an indication that there may be a breast cancer risk. But certainly there are so many different types of soy that people are consuming, and that might be why some of these differences are coming up in the research. And so at the Breast Cancer Fund, you know, dietary at the moment, based on the evidence we see, dietary soy doesn't seem to be an issue. We keep monitoring the research and see if that changes. But certainly there are phytoestrogens in soy, which in isolation do have an effect on breast cancer cells in culture. But within soy in a diet, that's not clear.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Kim. And let's go next to Naomi in Castro Valley. Hi, Naomi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I appreciate the show, and I know part of the show is about prevention. And I would appreciate each panelist just commenting on the most important point of prevention that you know.
All right, great. So what is at the top of your list, Shirima?
I just try and avoid estrogenic chemicals, so BPA, phthalates in plastic. I just try and avoid anything that could disrupt our hormonal system. And we have a bunch of tips on our website, breastcancerfund.org, which tell you how to do that.
All right. And what about you, Joyce?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a tough question at the same time. I think it's actually almost impossible to avoid things piece by piece. You know, we'll try to avoid BPA, but what they substitute BPA, and it's worse than what it is. Top of our list is to push for the Safe Chemicals Act. I think unless we go for some real clear policy reform that will allow testing of chemicals and monitoring of it, it almost becomes a futile exercise or an unequal exercise where some people can buy organic, some people can't. We really should put our energies into pushing something that will actually change the whole way we interact with the chemicals in our environment. Only 10% of the chemicals out there right now have been tested, tested at all, and we really need to make sure chemicals are safe before they come into our environment.
And that's the big argument that Sandra Steingraber makes. She writes extensively about chemicals, and she says, why is it that every individual needs to have a little EPA department in their home to keep track of all of this stuff? I mean, it's almost humanly impossible. This should really be up to the government. So can you talk about that and elaborate on her comment, Joyce, or respond to her comment?
Completely agree with it. Think about it. For your callers who are concerned, everybody's concerned, how much time should it be our responsibility to go to the store, read the label of everything that we eat or purchase? Cosmetics don't even have the ingredients on the label that really tells you what's in there. It is virtually impossible for anybody to avoid it, no matter how good they are. And testing on people's blood and their systems will show that all of us are carrying around so many different chemicals in our bodies, no matter how careful we are. So for me and for those of us at Breast Cancer Action and other organizations, we really feel together, let's put our energies in making some real change by putting the burden on the government so that demand a precautionary principle. Don't put a chemical out, and then when people start dying from it or getting sick from it, we then have to work to take it off. Let's make sure before the chemicals get out there, they're proven safe.
And Gabriella, what's at the top of your list?
Well, I think the top of my list, besides, I think, what has been mentioned on the political, I think there are things that each of us can do that are available to all of us. You know, and I think I don't have a top of the list, but I think the one thing that has been proven over and over is exercise. Any one of us, if we walk 30 minutes a day, decreases our risk of breast cancer and improves our survival. If you can't walk, do Sit and Be Fit on Channel 9. I think stress management is another thing. We cannot avoid stress. Life is incredibly stressful, but how each of us responds to stress, and I think there's a lot of evidence about how a high cortisol state, which is partly a result of when you're in that fight or flight response, which is part of what our culture encourages us to be in all the time. But I think when we learn different ways and recognize when we're in it, we improve our immune system. Getting enough sleep is crucial. All of these hormone receptor things are affected by sleep. Plastic, I think avoiding plastic in your life, not microwaving anything in plastic, stopping buying bottled water in plastic, all these drinks in plastics, lowering how much sugar you eat. There's a lot of good evidence that simple carbohydrates increase your insulin levels, which is one of the most pro-inflammatory molecules in the body, which it makes the immune system not work as well. And so I think those are my top ones, you know, as well as eating vegetables, organic, unorganic, eating vegetables. Vegetables are really high in folic acid, which has been shown to decrease the risk of breast cancer. So I think eating a diet high in mainly vegetables, secondary fruits, and whole grains, and eating less animal fat rather than more. You know, we can argue about vegetarianism or macrobiotic or whatever, but I think each of us needs a different kind of diet. But I think the fat in meat has a lot of the toxic chemicals in it that we've been talking about. So not eating animal fat products is important.
Can you talk a little bit more about sleep? Because I know a lot of people, myself included, sometimes get maybe 5 or 6 hours, and we know that's not good, but sometimes we need to hear why it's not good and why we need more sleep in order to get more sleep.
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence about what, one, the body has an incredible ability to heal itself, to repair itself. We're all exposed to cancerous cells in our body. A cancerous cell is an abnormal cell that the body is actually designed to recognize and get rid of. Now, that we've talked about are things that inhibit that or prevent that. But the body really is designed to heal itself. So sleep, we in this culture, we think of sleep as a waste of time, but the body does an incredible amount of repairing during sleep. There's also evidence that melatonin, which is both produced when you during the night, and it's kind of a catch-22, is part of what helps the immune system. So there are actually some studies on women taking high doses of melatonin to both improve survival of breast cancer and prevent breast cancer. So I think, again, it's something we don't know about. But we also know that in people who don't sleep enough, they make more cortisol. And cortisol is that adrenal hormone that, again, it turns on all kinds of parts of the immune system that not only increase your risk of cancer, but increase your risk of autoimmune diseases, which is another whole timely issue.
Well, those are all really, really amazing recommendations. And to this question, we have an email from Kitty who says, in 95 or 96, Science News had an article about a discovery that some of the chemicals in plastics imitate estrogen. They also discovered that heat promotes the release of these chemicals and that they witnessed cancer forming in breast tissue that was sitting in a plastic lab dish. It occurred to me, she writes, that there's a high probability that when people microwave food in a plastic-coated paper container, that they greatly increase their exposure to these chemicals. Could this be why there's so much more breast cancer in Marin County, for example? Families are too busy to cook in an oven and go for those microwavable meals. I suggest we stop storing and cooking food in plastic.
That's a fantastic recommendation. It's one we also recommend at Breast Cancer Fund is, and I'm sure Breast Cancer Act. We should not be heating plastic in the microwave with food in it and then eating that food.
Even stuff that says it's microwave.
Take it out of the plastic container, put it in glass or ceramic, and then put it in the microwave.
Do you oppose using the microwave at all?
No. It's mostly about plastics in the microwave and the effect of heat causing these chemicals to leach out into the food.
I wonder whether we shouldn't. I think we should not use a microwave on high. I think there's some data that it's the amount of energy that you use in a microwave. So I actually recommend to my clients that you don't ever use it on high. You use it on a medium setting. It takes longer, but it doesn't stir up the molecules as much. But I don't think we have good research.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. We have an email from Harvey who says, thanks for the show. The following article says it all. This is our hedge against cancer. Just say no to the sugar industry, especially high fructose corn sweetener, if we want to stay cancer free. Thank you for this article, Harvey. We will put a link at our website, yourcallradio.org, and we are actually in the process of planning a show about sugar.
If it were only that simple.
Yes, if it were. That's just one of many. Well, thank you for calling in or emailing. And let's go to our next caller. We actually have full line, so let's hear from Marty in Santa Cruz. Hi, Marty.
Hi. In the midst of this question about prevention versus cure, I wondered if you and your guests had any additional suggestions for my mother, who is in her late 80s, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer and had surgery to have a couple of tumors removed actually 2 or 3 years ago, but if there were any additional suggestions on helping to prevent a recurrence.
All right, who'd like to take that one?
I'll take it.
Okay.
You know, I think in her late 80s, the chance of having a recurrence are small if she were, you know, diagnosed stage 1, 2, even 3. I think the same recommendations we have about everything for everybody are the best recommendations. And I think a really important thing for us to remember is that you can do all, you can live your life perfectly and get breast cancer. And like Joyce is talking, most women who get breast cancer have no known risk factors. So I think it's very important for us to be clear that even though these are all things that hopefully will help prevent breast cancer, let's make sure we don't contribute to in any way women blaming themselves. Yeah. For if they'd only eaten this way, if they don't, you know, I think there's a lot of myth about, you know, suppressed anger. There's a lot of myth about all these factors. You know, if I hadn't microwaved, you know, this, I wouldn't have this. And I think, you know, the you know, I cringe when I hear that if you only don't eat sugar, you won't get breast cancer. I mean, I think it is such a complex disease. It's so part of this whole culture of toxicity that to me the most important thing is realize people do the best they can and then they have to let go.
Right, because you can be a 25-year-old vegan doing yoga and sort of quote-unquote all the right things and still get breast cancer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Joyce, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point and one that's really important. Again, you could do everything, quote-unquote, right and still get breast cancer. And that's why I'll always keep pushing that we have to take the burden off the individual.
Yes.
There are things we can do, yes, but that's not enough, and that's not going to ensure that we're really making a dent on the disease overall. And so it's got to be this dual approach of taking care of yourself but also looking at these larger issues that can truly make an impact for everybody.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call. And we have just over 5 minutes left. If you'd like to try to get a call in, it's 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Joyce Bickler is Deputy Director of Breast Cancer Action. Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer is one of the founders of the Charlotte Maxwell Complementary Clinic. She's been practicing as a holistic medical doctor for 33 years. And we're also joined by Shirima Rasanayagam. She's Director of Science at the Breast Cancer Fund. And let's hear from Stephanie in San Francisco. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Thanks for doing this show.
Thank you for calling.
I wondered if you could talk about thermograms as an alternative to mammograms for early breast cancer detection and prevention.
Yeah, we touched on that earlier.
Thermograms?
Shirima, would you like to address that just briefly?
Yeah, as we said before, mammograms are important for early detection. They're not really about prevention because what they do is detect cancers that have already started. Thermograms are a fascinating alternative, but much more research needs to be done until we know that they would be appropriate as an early detection method. But again, they would be about detecting breast cancer once it started rather than stopping it before it starts.
And is there information about this on your website?
We have some information on mammograms. Thermograms have. We haven't got a lot on thermograms right now because the research is still going on to validate them as an alternative to mammograms. And right now, they're not there yet. So.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that helps. And thank you for calling, Stephanie. Let's go to Brenda in San Francisco. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. I'm calling because I am basically the person you guys just described. I got breast cancer when I was 30, and no one in my family had ever even had cancer of any type. Mm. And I've been doing yoga for, I think, about 8 years at that point and eating mostly organic food. I've been a vegetarian since I was 16. And when I got sick, my friends were just stunned because I was the healthiest person out of all of us. And people would ask me, well, what do you think it was that caused it? And it was sort of like I'd roll my eyes and say, well, wow. You know, I ate a lot of McDonald's as a kid, and we had TV dinners growing up, and, you know, just sort of going backwards in time to when I had a less healthier diet. But at the end of the day, I mean, it really, you can only do so much, like everyone's been saying. And, you know, like, I don't use plastic. I don't microwave plastic anymore, like all the kind of BPA stuff I've been reading about. But, you know, what I was told when I was going through chemo was that women who are slightly more overweight and who are alcoholics actually tend to do better in chemotherapy because their body is used to a constant state of dehydration. And that just sealed the deal for me. I was like, all right, great. I could have been overweight and a drinker, and I might actually be feeling better than I feel now. So,
wow. And Brenda, how are you today?
I'm good. I actually went into remission last year. And my oncologist says I am not only the healthiest cancer patient she has, but I'm actually just the healthiest person she knows.
Wow.
So we'll see how it goes. I mean, I've got a long way to go to get to the end of my life without getting sick again. But, you know, I think, like everyone's been saying, I mean, I think the bigger thing, instead of just, you know, I mean, obviously eating better and being conscious about your own body, is really talking about getting the government involved and seriously looking at some of the BPA stuff that's going on and the toxic substances. Because if you're breathing, you can get cancer.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, they've done studies about chemical-causing particles in the air. The New York Times had a huge expose on this. I believe it was last year. A very lengthy piece. So thank you so much for calling in. Thanks for sharing your story, and good luck with the rest of your journey. Thank you so much. We'll get a response in just a couple minutes. I want to take a few more phone calls. Let's go to Susan in San Francisco. Hi,
yes,
Susan.
Thank you for keeping this discussion open, and I really think it is a lot about product testing and product safety, and we can look to European standards of models for the precautionary principle of testing products. And I think a lot of it has to do with getting the FDA and the EPA to do their job. This is definitely beyond a local fix and beyond blaming the individual victims, and getting our national agencies to do the job that they should. And I'd like to recommend a website, EWG.org, the Environmental Working Group, where you can type in a product and see if it actually causes cancer. Because I shop at Safeway. There are pink and blue ribbons all over, blue for prostate cancer, and their products cause cancer. So it's more about talking about what's on the shelves and what we can do about the carcinogens in the products that are on the shelves that cause illness in general. A lot of them are linked to reproductive harm as well as neurotoxicity. So please do keep this discussion going. Thank you so much.
We will. It's very important. Thank you for calling. Let's hear next from Molly in Monterey. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I just wanted to insert in the conversation, there is an outstanding book that came out a few years ago, and it's a review by one of the researchers, is Wiley, W-Y-L-I-E, who did the book on hormones a few years ago. And there's it's an excellent book about the value of sleep and what's been found in all kinds of medical research regarding the need for sleep in the body, and it's called Lights Out. So I really recommend that as a comprehensive, at least a start, at looking at the real value of sleep.
Thank you so much. I'm putting this on my show ideas, and I will bring this up at our next editorial meeting. I think this is a very important topic. Thank you for the recommendation. And let's hear from Aaron in Oakland. Hi, Aaron.
Good morning. I just wanted to connect two dots in connection with the GMO and soy discussion you had earlier. So it is true that I think it's 90%, a huge percentage of the non-organic soy products on the market are already genetically modified. And there is an initiative that has now qualified for the ballot in November that will require the labeling of all genetically modified foods. So I just want to make people aware of that. I don't think we have a number yet, but let's support it.
All right, thank you. Well, I want to leave time to get final thoughts. I'm sorry we can't take your call, Nancy, but Nancy's calling to say again that it's impossible for a single person to navigate these chemicals, and getting cancer or not is mostly just an issue of luck. But I also wanted to take Armand's email, because he brings up a really important question about breast cancer and men. We did a show about a really great documentary, Semper Fi, and they looked at water contamination at Camp Lejeune, and I believe it's North Carolina, and they found that at least 74 men who lived at this base had been diagnosed with breast cancer, the highest rate in the country. And Armand wanted to know, is there a difference between men and women when it comes to breast cancer? Gabriella?
Yeah, men have worse outcomes. I mean, they do have, you know, much less incidence, but I think, you know, because of all the chemicals in the environment, we are definitely seeing a dramatic increase in breast cancer in men. It's still tiny compared to women.
Right. Right, but 74 on one base is a huge number.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it really shows the environmental link. And, you know, I think the thing is, we've known this for years. You know, Silent Spring came out in the 70s. I mean, we've known about this. It's such a deep cultural, you know, part of our system. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I mean, it's so sinister, like so many things. I mean, there are many people on the boards of the drug companies that make these chemicals to cure cancer that are also on the boards of many of the toxic chemical producers. So I I think the need for political action around this is so important. I want to just,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. And that, Joyce, what would you add to that in about 30 seconds? I mean, when you're talking about the fact we've done shows about this for years, that only 10% of chemicals have even been tested.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, certainly I'll say again, Safe Chemicals Act, but I think overall where you live, work, and play are probably the more critical factors of how are going to be your social determinants of health. So if you're working on a base where there's toxic chemicals, no matter what you do, you're going to have a higher risk of health problems, and not a lot you're going to do about it till after they discover the connection. So, I think, again, everything we're saying is that we all need to work together to kind of change our system to make this a better place.
And Shirima, what would you add to that?
Absolutely. We need to work together, the Breast Cancer Action, Breast Cancer Fund, and EWG and a number of other organizations are working together on the Safe Chemicals Act. The Safe Cosmetics Act as well is something that we're involved with through the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics that Breast Cancer Action is also a member of. And there's information on all of our legislative programs on our website, breastcancerfund.org, including how you can get involved with them, and also tips for personal action. I mean, as we say, it's important that we change our chemical environment for all of us through political action, but there are a few things you can do to reduce your risk. So,
and on the politics, is the chemical lobby the group that's really stopping the Safe Chemicals Act and the Safe Cosmetics Act? Is that the main barrier here?
I would say so.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, follow us. Think before you pink.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. That's right, and hopefully, yes, but we think it's important to talk about this on the other months besides October, or I should say in addition to October. Joyce Bickler is Deputy Director of Breast Cancer Action, author of Joyce Bickler, DES Daughter. Dr. Gabriella Heinzheimer is one of the founders of the Charlotte Maxwell Complementary Clinic, and Shirima Rasanayagam is Director of Science at the Breast Cancer Fund. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you
and
very
thank
much.
You for... Thank you, and thanks for your excellent phone calls and emails. We will definitely follow this issue. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is Silicon Valley's political agenda? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about political power in Silicon Valley. Who are the big tech companies and their executives giving money to? Is there any sign that their political commitments have changed since 2008? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. President Obama raises millions from Silicon Valley. So what are the policies and legislation that matter to tech companies? And who's calling the shots? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.